You're in with Dolores Cahill on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Dolores Cahill Show on TNTRadio.live. And today we are in Bath in England at the World Council for Health Conference. And I was talking in the first hour with Simone Plout. And Simone, your area is in risk assessment and you've looked at the masks. So we just thought we'd return to that subject, and maybe there are long-term consequences of the masks, and that really not only do they not help in this COVID-19 issue, as you were explaining, they also can cause harm to everybody wearing them, but especially to children and young people.
Yeah, absolutely, Dolores. The big problem is that the blood oxygen level falls. So that's not good for the children's brains, for their brain development, for their learning. They complain when they're wearing them of feeling tired, getting headaches. And I remember while I was doing the research, I was in a meeting and I checked the CO2 level in the room. There were a large number of people in a small room that was poorly ventilated. And I actually got up to around 5,000 parts per million, which is the occupational exposure limit, but it's the legal limit for CO2. And I felt drowsy, my brain was not functioning properly, and we are expecting children to learn in school under those conditions. We're basically handicapping those children's ability to learn in class by putting them in masks. The other problem, of course, is that high CO2 levels, which is what happens behind in the dead space within the mask, causes a paralysis of the little cilia, the little hairs that waft mucus up from the lung to keep the lung clean. Those hairs are paralyzed. So those children end up effectively with a smoker's cough because they're not able to clear mucus out of their lungs. And that mucus clearing is how any particles or fibers that might get into the lungs are cleared away and the lungs are kept clean. So there is a buildup of this debris that's coming off the masks and getting into the lungs. And the other thing is that the high CO2 levels actually hamper and compromise the immune function of white cells within the lungs as well. So it's harm after harm. And then, of course, you've got bacteria from sort of spittle and respiratory droplets saturating the mask, which can become so saturated, it's like wearing a plastic bag over your face. And we know we've got warnings in plastic bags. Don't allow children to play with these because they can end up over the face and suffocate the child. And yet there we are basically suffocating the children in the class by wearing the masks, which don't actually function in the way that we've been told they function because they're just not of a specification or indeed fitted and tailored to the face of the child in a way that would actually provide any protection. But it's harm after harm after harm.
So I suppose if you were a teacher listening, particularly where we are all very concerned about children and young people wearing and having to wear these masks or being coerced or forced to wear masks in the school. So if you were a teacher or a principal or a parent or a grandparent, and now you are concerned that, you know, even I was passing a school yesterday and children were coming out after their exams, about 20% of them were wearing masks, even though they're entirely unnecessary. So if you're a parent, grandparent or a teacher or principal in a school, what can we do now? Like, have they, I know you've worked with the unions, what can they do to try and in their school stop the children having to be wearing these masks?
I would say that the answer is education, it's information and it's empowerment. It's very intimidating to be the only child in the class who's not wearing a mask. But if you're one of many, it's a lot more empowering. If you're the only family at one school that are saying no masks, then that's really intimidating. Power in numbers, empowerment, education, information, and clubbing together and joining together. So there's power in numbers, and that can be overwhelming for a school if they've got a lot of people saying, no, we're not doing this.
So then, you know, listeners to this show will know that I often raise the issue of, you know, first do no harm. and the liability on employers or on principals of schools. Can you just mention the long-term consequences of the masks on these young people over their lifetime? And is there any way that we can hold people to account for the liability of harm today, but also future harm? Because these children will have a lower IQ, basically, because they're oxygen starved. And also if they have the microplastics in the lungs, that will affect their breathing for their whole lives.
Well, the harm in terms of lowered IQ, I was speaking to a neurologist yesterday here at the conference, and she was saying that blood oxygen levels are lowered when you've got acidosis caused by the high CO2 levels in the blood. And so that is going to cause, it's going to compromise the brain function. So those children are going to have a loss of IQ points. That we've also got the risk of all these microplastics fibers causing fibrosis of the lung. We used to see that horrible thing when people had been working down coal mines. You know, we don't send children down coal mines anymore, but we're doing it in a different way through these dreadfully ill-advised mask mandates for children in schools. And as children need far more oxygen because they've got a high metabolic rate, they're growing as well as breathing, and they're trying to learn, which takes extra oxygen. You've got to think and question. So in order to learn, you need a high oxygen throughput to keep your brain active. We are denying them the oxygen they need to learn. And as a society, this is blood on our hands.
So I know you've worked with the unions as well, but are there precedence cases where parents have challenged schools or people have employed challenged and successfully push back on masks for employers or schools?
There are definitely precedents where there's been pushback. The schools don't admit it, but suddenly they change their policies. So they're not admitting that it's pressure, but when pressure is brought to bear, we are seeing a reversal of policy and relaxation of the requirements. I've seen through work with the Workers of England Union, I've seen empowering people, perhaps, you know, particularly individuals working in the care sector. If those people are empowered through information, knowing they're not alone, knowing they're not just a lone voice and they're a minority, if they realise that they're part of a lot bigger group, then they feel empowered to stand up against the tyranny that they're being subjected to. And it's really a matter of empowerment as well as education.
Well, I suppose that's hopeful news because, you know, many of us have been studying it. There is under this Agenda 21, the potential that they want to have waves of pandemics over the years to come. So in a way, there is a duty on us to really push back on these kind of unnecessary measures now so that if they come with some other so-called pandemic in a year or two time, that they can't implement the same measures again. So that my guest there was just Simone Plaut, who's an absolute expert on risk assessments. And Simone is staying with us. But we have another guest from Ireland, my beautiful home country, and it's Maeve Murren. Welcome, Maeve. And I know you're one of the co-founders of Health Freedom Ireland. So maybe if you just give us some background on yourself while you're at the conference and a little bit about Health Freedom Ireland.
Thank you, Dolores, for inviting me to speak. And it's wonderful to be in your company again, because we've obviously worked with you in the past.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much. But my background is I'm 23 years a complementary health therapist, and I suffered vaccine injury myself in 1994 as a result of holiday jabs. And I felt there was a huge need for a platform for the voices of the vaccine injured to be heard. So ironically, it started in 2019. And of course, then 2020 hit and we found ourselves in the middle of a maelstrom is the only word for it. Because suddenly we went from childhood vaccines and all these other things like HPV into COVID. Yeah. And suddenly this thing just escalated out of, you know, all control. So it was sort of overwhelming, but exciting at the same time, because we began to see now that the truth of what had been going on for so long was coming out. And we worked with yourself, as you know, Dolores. But I suppose today I'm here to tell you a little bit about the information of what we've done in Health Freedom Ireland to try and bring, I suppose, leverage and traction to really show people the truth and transparency around these issues. And so what we did was our first, I think, endeavour was we wrote to all of the GPs in Ireland, 6,600 GPs through our community, our volunteers who were absolutely amazing. We sent letters to every doctor in the country on hydroxychloroquine. We set up a dedicated email, which we said, look, if you guys want to come back to us and talk to us about this, we can really give you information on how efficacious it is, how safe it is, the Sunday drug that's been there for 60 years. And I know you had hugely promoted it yourself, Dolores. Right.
And what month, just for the listeners, when did you write those? And they were notices, weren't they?
I'm just trying to think timeline-wise. You get so confused because those 24 months of, I think it would have been around, I'm thinking the pandemic started March 2020 in Ireland. Well, that's when we first became conscious of it. And I think it was towards the end of that year.
Of 2020.
Yeah. You know.
And what kind of letters? What was the name of those letters that you wrote?
We wrote to every GP and we literally gave them every study. We gave them links to all of the hydroxychloroquine and its, you know, effectiveness in relation to treating COVID and how it was so safe to even give to pregnant women. And we were really trying to say, look, there's an alternative here to actually just, you know, waiting for a vaccine and treating people in a way that was causing death. And really, HCQ worked and we knew that it was effective. But sadly, you know, the powers that be did not want that actually brought into Ireland. And there was a huge controversy around it. And we unfortunately had such a disappointing response from the GPs. I think we had one GP contacted us and said, I've seven doctors in practice, take them off your database. I'm tearing up the letters. And then we had another one who came on and said we were to take him off the database as well. We were never to write to him again. We were conspiracy theorists and anti-vaxxers. And, you know, there was absolutely nothing in that letter except primary sourced scientific information. There was no reason why they would actually have any of that to say to us, because all we were doing was providing education. And as this lady before said, empowering them to actually look up and say for themselves, like, this is actually something we could use. This is something we could work with.
And so you were writing these notices of liabilities to the doctors in Ireland. But what's interesting now is a year or two later, hydroxychloroquine and also Nobel Prize winning ivermectin, that are some of the safest drugs in the world, would have actually worked if they had been used and prevent, you know, suffering and illness and death.
Absolutely. And we did actually notify everybody about ivermectin as well. But it was really more that we wanted to get that out to the public. We realized we weren't getting anywhere with the doctors. They were sticking to the narrative predominantly. They weren't kind of rocking the boat. And so we started on a campaign of ivermectin. We had made a wonderful connection with Dr. Larry, who's here today, amazing lady,
yes,
and Pierre Curry. We'd had a webinar with them and we had got a huge amount of information. We thought, we've got to get this out to Irish people. We've got to tell them that this is available to treat them. Again, it sort of fell flat. You know, you get to the stage where you think every time you do one of these huge initiatives, oh my God, this is going to be so powerful and so successful. And then, of course, nothing happens because, you know, the powers that be are so strong and there's really no energy there behind trying to drive something that could really help people. It's just so disheartening, Dolores.
So, I mean, you also have a network of volunteers, but because in a way we might move on, because people weren't given these safe and effective and licensed drugs in Ireland in January 2021, there was then the rollout of the injections, particularly in the care homes across Ireland. And I know you've done a huge amount of work. If you just wanted to describe some of the research and analysis that you've done in Health Freedom Ireland on the result of the injection, particularly in the care homes in Ireland.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is such a passionate thing, so close to my heart. I have a 91-year-old aunt who's been locked away for 2 years, who was totally coerced into getting these jabs. They told her she would not be allowed out of the home if she didn't take the jabs. And she's just had a stroke a week before I came here. Yeah, and I mean, I've seen this across the board. In January of 2021, just if I can go back a little bit before that, March and April, our government told everybody, oh, we have to protect the elderly and the vulnerable. So everybody has to actually wear their masks, they have to quarantine, you can't go to church, you can't have weddings, you can't do this. But in that same year, they moved a huge amount of elderly people from the hospitals, infectious, without testing them, into the nursing homes. And as you know, we had a massive hike in the deaths. We had the great Dr. Marcus de Bruijn. Absolutely,
a real hero.
And he actually resigned his position because it was a maelstrom again for these nursing homes. I mean, this is the thing, they're talking about negligence and abuse in nursing homes. These nursing homes had a terrible time, you know, really
yes,
difficult.
And Dr. Marcus de Bruijn was one of the first doctors in Ireland and in the world. But in April 2020, he wrote a very authoritative report called Mismanagement in the Care Homes in Ireland. And he described in real time in April 2020 how the elderly were being moved in from the hospitals into these care homes, but also not being given oxygen. There wasn't enough oxygen and they weren't being given hydroxychloroquine that was well known at the time that would have saved their lives.
Absolutely. And the PPE equipment, everything, it was so badly managed and that. But ironically, we fast forward a little bit. Now, interestingly enough, between that time, we didn't have massive what we would call deaths in the home. March 2020, April 2020, big deaths because of that. But then right through till January of 2021, there was just the normal level of deaths. And then suddenly you have skyscraper deaths again in January and February. And I can say that you can go and look it up. And how I will tell you how it happened, we have a group of amazing volunteers who work in statistics, analysis, research. And we actually went to RIP, which, as you know, is our national way of recording deaths in Ireland. And we actually got them and they sat for weeks and weeks enthralled through that, along with the deaths in the nursing homes and the scheduled dates for vaccine rollouts. So there's a lot of work here, Dolores, and it was done really meticulously.
Yeah.
And by the time we got to the end of the research, we discovered that there was a 425% increase in the deaths in the nursing homes in Ireland. 425%.
And that was directly after the rollout of the injections, because I know I was involved with you in doing some of the analysis in the spring of 2021. And I know there was one care home where there was 51 elderly and the injections, they were injected on the 21st of January, 2021. And within 2 weeks, 19 of those 51 people had died.
Yeah.
Because we've been involved in looking at the death certs.
Yes.
And 8 of them died within 48 hours.
Yeah.
And they were put down, many of the deaths, as COVID-19.
Yeah.
And many of those deaths on the death certs, they also had Alzheimer's. So they could not have given full and informed consent.
No. No. And in my own case, my aunt was in the home at the time. And I have to say, I fought like a lioness to stop her getting shots. And it was interesting. They phoned me on the Wednesday and I had a very heated debate. How heated it was, my husband came down the stairs and said, "Oh my God, who are you talking to?" And ironically, the following Wednesday, I got a call to say that they had 19 sick patients in the home and 5 staff seriously ill, and that she would have to be moved and quarantined because she was there and she wasn't vaccinated. So she wasn't sick. Do you understand? It was the ones who'd been vaccinated. I obviously, this is the whole thing I've said to you earlier, Dolores. Can we say correlation equals causation? Maybe we can't. And this has been thrown at us all the time. How do you know these people were vaccinated? The fact is, and I said it to you earlier, you talk to any statistician who has any kind of expertise, they will tell you a red flag as big as 425% increase should and must be investigated thoroughly. And that's all we're asking for. We shut down our society in Ireland. We decimated lives. People committed suicide. People missed out on cancer treatments. Children are traumatized. Mental health, physical abuse in the homes. All these things happened as a result of us supposedly protecting the elderly and the vulnerable. We failed abysmally to even do that. If you look at how many people have been actually experienced such illness and such suffering and death from these vaccinations in the homes. And I will do everything I can, my life's blood, to actually bring truth to that situation.
Yeah. And maybe if you just want to give some information on the website as well, if people want to support you. And I know you have hundreds and thousands of volunteers as well.
Yes, we have a large group. And even within my own colleagues within the steering committee, I just want to take this opportunity. It's been a tumultuous 2 years. I think I'm here this weekend at the Better Way conference with a dodgy neck and I suppose the weight of responsibility. You know, you think to yourself, how did I end up in the middle of all of this? Like, how has this happened to fall on top of me? Who am I to have taken this on? But I want to thank them all so much. The most important thing I would say is this would not have happened without our community in Ireland. Those who are passionate, those who have literally gone to the nth degree to do what they can to try and change things for the better. You know, it's a really emotional time for all of us. And I really feel this weekend, it's just fantastic to be here and to be with people like yourself and all the wonderful people here with us today and to try and find a way to create a new world based on truth and good health and good medicine and proper science and just find our way back to something that's authentic, Dolores. Yeah.
No, absolutely. Because, you know, what I often think as well is in that care home with 51 people, you and I went through the death certs, and I know it was shocking that, you know, for them, within 2 weeks, 19 of their family were dead. And within 5 weeks, 26 of the 51 people had died in that one care home.
Yeah.
And there has been no investigation.
No. And can I tell you, we wrote to every elected representative in the country. We wrote to every regulatory body, including the HSE, HICWA, Department of Health, Department of the Taoiseach. And I did 13 press releases myself to all of the national papers and including RTE, our national radio station and television station. Nothing, Dolores. I mean, we got some pathetic responses back. And to one of the organisations, including the Health Products Regulatory Authority, which is the equivalent body for supposedly monitoring and protecting the well-being of Ireland in relation to intervention of any kind, medically, drug-wise, nothing. You know, it has just been so heartbreaking and just absolutely, you know, I just don't know where, what words to even find it, a sense of disappointment and just grief, because I think there has been huge grief and outcry.
So, you know, what I think is that, you know, these people in the safety authorities or in the health system, they actually are paid. Their job is to make sure that people are not, that products are not on the market that are harming or causing the death of people. So why do you think, in a way, they're not doing their job? What, why do you think they're not doing their job? Or would you agree with me they're not doing their job?
I absolutely would agree that they're not doing their job. I mean, why they're not doing it, I think, is probably fear of career decimation, character, you know, their character being anyone who's spoken out in Ireland. As you know yourself, Dolores, I've been called a conspiracy theorist, a white supremacist. I've been told I'm an anti-vaxxer. I mean, I was damaged by vaccines myself in 94, so that's just pure stupidity.
Yeah.
But I think there is a terrible fear that if you don't go with the narrative, you will lose your money, you will lose your ability. I spoke recently, we tried recently to set up a vaccine injury victim video, and we worked really hard for weeks on liaising with all the vaccine injured victims. And we spoke to people. It was absolutely heartbreaking. A 31-year-old father with an enlarged heart, another girl having up to 120 seizures a day, a 14-year-old boy who had a stroke after his second jab, and one man, a doctor, who was actually had a heart attack, but was terrified. He said to me, I have 5 children relying on me. He said, if I speak out, he said, I lose my income. How do I pay for their education? How do I pay for my mortgage? So this is the leverage that they have over people. And that is why I think so many are just turning a blind eye. But like, this will never end unless people step up to the plate and say, you know, it has to stop here. It has to stop with me. We have to lose fear and actually do the right thing.
Very good. And, you know, there is a campaign that's going to be launched next week. Is Can We Talk About It? And it's led from Sweden by Aga Wilson, who used to be in the United Nations. And next weekend, the show will just have people that have had adverse events. So she said that in Ireland, they could hardly find anyone with adverse events that was willing to speak out. Is that your experience
as
well?
Yes, that would publicly be my experience. Yeah. I mean, I had all of these people who were willing to speak out, but as it when came to the last minute, a huge amount of them just bottled. You know, there's that terrible fear as well that there's going to be lashback from the public. Some of them also, Dolores, are so ill. You know, you're talking about people with really, really serious illnesses. So for them to actually try to even get to a hotel venue, at one stage, we were actually going to send somebody out, some of our kind volunteers in the media side of things. We're going to go to their homes and we were going to do little kind of snippets of videos with each person. But on one occasion, what can you do with a girl who's having 110 seizures a day? You know, how do you deal with a man who can't walk up the stairs without his wife bringing him up the stairs? Like, these people are really sick and they're traumatized. So for them to even take on this extra bit of stress, it's just too much. It's just too much.
But I suppose one of the things, and I'm sure you find it as well, is that if they were, which many of them were, perfectly healthy before they got the injection, don't we all have a duty for them to speak out so that other people don't have to suffer the same way?